Broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain, BC, we are CJSF 90.1 FM, and we are diverse, independent, and yours.
During this period, Mark Twain emerged as a particularly vituperative critic of imperialism. He said that Americans who were fighting in foreign wars were using a bandit's musket under a polluted flag. In fact, he wanted to change the flag of the United States to replace the stars with skull and crossbone symbols. So I feel now that we've bleached the image of Mark Twain. We've made him too much into a pleasant dinner guest, when actually he was not a friendly dinner guest at all, as Theodore Roosevelt came to realize.
That's Stephen Kinzer, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. Welcome to this special 4th of July program featuring Stephen Kinzer on Theodore Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and American Empire. Why has the United States intervened so often in foreign lands? What are its origins? Having expanded its borders largely through its destruction of indigenous peoples, the U.S. went on to project its power globally. Today, its empire of bases rings the earth. According to Monthly Review, the U.S. has at least 800 military bases located in 85 countries. Historically, military interventions and invasions have been a bipartisan affair. Republicans and Democrats will, at the most, only question tactics. It wasn't always that way. There was a period in U.S. history when there was a fierce debate about Washington's use of force around the world. It centered on two factions, one led by Theodore Roosevelt and the other by none other than Mark Twain. The themes and debates of the past resonate today. The names change, but policy is fairly constant. To talk about these issues is Stephen Kinzer. He was a New York Times correspondent and bureau chief in Nicaragua, Germany, and Turkey. He currently teaches at Brown University. He's the author of many books, including Overthrow, All the Shah's Men, The Brothers, and The True Flag. This classic from the AR archive was recorded in 2017 at Brown. And now, Stephen Kinzer.
We have never had a president before who was destitute of self-respect and of respect for his high office. We've had no president before who was not a gentleman. We've had no president before who was intended for a butcher, a dive keeper, or a bully. No, those words were not written this week. That's Mark Twain talking about Theodore Roosevelt. They were marvelously matched antagonists at the end of the 19th century. In some ways, they were quite different. Roosevelt believed that war was the only suitable pursuit for a man or a nation. At one point, he actually wrote to his bosom friend, Henry Cabot Lodge, speculating on whether it would be possible to arrange for Germany to bombard and burn some cities on the east coast of the U.S. so the United States could get more actively involved in a war. Mark Twain was quite different. Mark Twain had traveled to places where European imperialism was well rooted. He had seen the results in places like South Africa, India, the South Seas. And he had a very different view of what the role of imperialism was. On the other hand, in a certain way, they were well matched and equal. They were both activists and writers as well as thinkers. And both of them created their own personas. They had great egos, and they invented themselves. These were people who could never turn away from a crowd or a photographer or an interviewer. Aware of each other's popularity, they never attacked each other in public. But we know from their writings and their comments what they really thought of each other. So Twain described Roosevelt as clearly insane. And undoubtedly the most formidable disaster that has befallen the country since the Civil War. Roosevelt returned the favor by saying he would like to skin Mark Twain alive. Now, what were they arguing about? They represented two poles in an argument that consumed the United States 120 years ago and that still consumes us. All of our foreign policy choices in the United States could be reduced essentially down to one word, which is intervention. We're always trying to figure out, where do we intervene in the world? When? With what tools? Under what circumstances? With what goals? We imagine that we're coming up with new arguments and that this is our new debate. But actually, this debate is actually quite old. It goes back more than a century. I teach about the Spanish-American War, and I'm pretty familiar with that history. But there's a huge piece of it that I never understood, that I never knew, that's not in any of the books. During this period, the United States made a huge decision. When the Senate began its epochal debate, which I'll talk about in a moment, one senator started out by saying, "This is the greatest question that has ever been presented to the American people." It was. He was right. And it still is. But that question was not decided easily. This huge choice, we're not going to stop at the borders of North America, we're going to project our coercive and military power abroad, was made by very narrow margins. And the debate consumed the United States for several years. It was on the front pages of newspapers every day. Every single major political and intellectual figure in America took part in this debate. And the themes that come up in this debate have resonated all the way up to the present day. I never ceased to be amazed as I was going through the congressional record and the newspapers and magazines of that era with how astonishingly current all the arguments are. Every argument we make for intervention and every argument we make against intervention starts here. As I was reading through these debates, I thought, this sounds just like what we said when we were debating Vietnam, whether to get involved in Central America, whether to be involved in Iraq. In the history of American foreign policy, this is truly the mother of all debates. Although the big difference is, of course, the senators were so much more articulate then. It's truly sobering to read through these speeches and see how beautifully crafted they are, how full of historical references they are, how insightful they are, with references to Pliny the Elder and the Catiline conspiracy and things you probably wouldn't want to discuss with very many senators today. For those of you who were not in my recent lecture on the Spanish-American War, my History of American Intervention class, and might have forgotten that one class you took in high school about the Spanish-American War, let me just refresh your memory and set the scene for what was happening at that moment. Cuban patriots were rising up against Spanish rule in the late 1890s. At the same time, coincidentally, in New York City, William Randolph Hearst was pioneering what was then called yellow journalism, what we now call fake news. Hearst's newspapers, which I painstakingly went through for many hours in the New York Public Library, essentially had the same rotating diet of stories. It was murder, suicide, child abuse, and political corruption. And then it would start again. But with an entrepreneur's clever eye, Hearst realized that this cycle got a little stale after a while. The stories start to blend into each other. And as everyone in the news business knows, the way to get people to tune in every day or buy a paper every day is to have what we call a running story, a story that's going every day. So you need to buy the next day's paper to find out what's going to happen. War is the best running story of all. And William Randolph Hearst understood this. He made a point of bringing to Americans the extremes of brutality that Cuban people were suffering under Spanish oppression. I saw one story, for example, that took up an entire page with some quite graphic illustrations, truly heartrending piece, about a holding pen where suspect villagers were being held by Spanish officers. They were not given food. They were not given medical care. There were no sanitary facilities. They were starving. They were sick. They were fly covered. Rodents were feeding on them. And the reporter at the peak of the story, explains how he actually watched a mother and then a few minutes later her small baby die in front of his eyes in one of these holding pens. It later turned out this reporter had never even been in Cuba. Hearst fed Americans a diet of this kind of fake news that drove them wild. His greatest coup of fake news, of course, was the sinking of the USS Maine in Havana Harbor. His headline was, "Sinking of the Maine was the work of an enemy." And he actually published on the front page a giant drawing showing how the Spanish sunk the Maine. It took 70 years for the U.S. Navy to convene a review board under Admiral Hyman Rickover that concluded the Maine was blown up by a spark inside the furnace. But at the time, that kind of news was very effective. I fear it still is. So, armed with this outrage, the United States decided we should send troops to Cuba to help the Cuban rebels defeat the Spanish. As we were doing this, our military planners realized that it was important for us to find and sink the Spanish fleet, wherever it was in the world, to be sure that that fleet would not attack the U.S. mainland in retribution for our attacks in Cuba. We discovered that the fleet was in a place that no American had ever heard of, and that was the Philippine Islands. Even President McKinley later said, "I couldn't have told you where those darned islands were within 1,000 miles. We did send a squadron to the Philippines. We destroyed the Spanish fleet there. But then we didn't know what to do. Suddenly, there were the Philippines. We had never thought about the Philippines. This war was about Cuba. Suddenly, we found ourselves in a far-off part of the world. This brought Americans to a crucial moment. In 1890, the U.S. Census Bureau famously declared the American frontier closed. That meant there's no more land to settle inside North America. This brought us to a great crisis, to a great crossroads. What do we do now? You could argue the United States has been an expansionist nation ever since the Pilgrims landed. But we'd finally reached the extent of our North American continent. Should we then be satisfied and look inward and try to devote our energies to building up our nation? Or should we continue doing what we have been doing since the Pilgrims landed, and that is pushing further? At the end of 1898, the U.S. government imposed on Spain a treaty called the Treaty of Paris, by which we acquired Spanish territories. We acquired Puerto Rico, Guam, the Philippines, for which we paid $20 million. Spain and also had to surrender control over Cuba. So this was the great moment for us. But that treaty, the Treaty of Paris, had to be ratified by the U.S. Senate. That was the climax of this great debate. But the debate had begun even as the Americans were beginning their war in Cuba. A huge force arose in America, actually originally from Boston, during 1898. It's one that doesn't appear in your history books, the Anti-Imperialist League. This organization had chapters all over America, held meetings in dozens of cities, circulated hundreds of thousands of leaflets and newsletters, and attracted some of the leading figures in America. So the vice presidents included Andrew Carnegie, the richest man in America, and a few people with whom you wouldn't expect to see Andrew Carnegie sitting around a table, like Jane Addams, the great social reformer, Samuel Gompers, the principal labor leader of that era, Booker T. Washington, the most prominent African American of that period, intellectuals like William James, politicians like Democrat William Jennings Bryan, Republican Benjamin Harrison, the immediate past president, Grover Cleveland. All these people were involved in the anti-imperialist movement. The first meeting in American history to protest the policy of expansion abroad was held on June 15th, 1898, in Faneuil Hall in Boston. And here is a snippet from the opening speech by a Boston clergyman and theologian. "The policy of imperialism threatens to change the temper of our people. and to put us into a permanent attitude of arrogance, testiness, and defiance toward other nations. Once we enter the field of international conflict as a great military and naval power, we shall be one more bully among bullies. We shall only add one more to the list of oppressors of mankind. William Jennings Bryan, who was the leader of the Democratic Party at that time, was an even more vivid orator. He was steeped in biblical imagery, and his speeches are quite potent. How about this one? When the desire to steal becomes uncontrollable in an individual, he is declared a kleptomaniac and is sent to an asylum. When the desire to grab land becomes uncontrollable in a nation, we are told that the currents of destiny are flowing through the hearts of men, and the American people are entering upon a manifest mission. Shame upon the logic which locks up the petty offender and enthrones grand larceny. So, at the beginning of 1899, the Senate convened for its epochal 32-day debate over ratification of the Treaty of Paris. But it wasn't just about that treaty, and it wasn't just about the Philippines. It was about a much larger question. It's a question we're still arguing today. And that is it right for the United States, a country that was a former colony, that came to being by overthrowing the rule of an outside power, to be imposing its rule on other peoples? Is this the correct course for the United States? We debated that for several years at the turn of the century. The Senate took up the debate in these important 32 days. And although a kind of resolution was reached, we're still struggling over whether this is the right thing for America to do. Let me give you a sense of that wonderful debate. Senator William Mason of Illinois. For over 100 years, every lover of liberty has pointed to this sentence: all just powers of government are derived from the consent of the governed. This sentence has been a pillar of fire by night and a cloud by day to the downtrodden and oppressed around the world. No, Mr. President, we will not amend that sentence now. Not liberty, Mr. President, for your family as I prescribe it. Not liberty for you or your children at my dictation, not Austrian liberty for the Hungarians, not Spanish liberty for Cuba, not English liberty for the United States, aye, and not American liberty for the Philippines, but universal liberty for which our fathers died. The answer then comes back from another, a great imperialist figure from Indiana, Albert Beveridge, another brilliant speaker who used rhetoric as the way to propel himself from poverty up to power. The opposition tells us that we ought not to govern a people without their consent. I answer, the rule of liberty, that all just government derives its authority from the consent of the governed, applies only to those who are capable of self-government. This, of course, had a heavy racial overtone. It meant that countries populated by white people can rule themselves, but those populated by anyone else need to be ruled by white people. And that was an argument that was repeatedly made during this debate. Two of the antagonists in this great Senate debate were both Republican senators from Massachusetts. One was Henry Cabot Lodge. Lodge was a key member of the imperialist triumvirate, you could call it. So he was the Mephistopheles behind the other senators and the real conceiver of the imperial project. Hearst was the mighty megaphone, and Theodore Roosevelt, of course, was the public face of the imperial project. So here's Henry Cabot Lodge, and ask yourself if this is not an argument we still hear today. I do not believe that this nation was raised up for nothing. I have faith that it has a great mission in the world, a mission of good, a mission of freedom. I believe that it can live up to that mission. Therefore, I want to see it step forward boldly and take its place at the head of nations. To which his Republican colleague, George Frisbie Hoar, cried back, "You have no right at the cannon's mouth to impose on an unwilling people your Declaration of Independence and your Constitution and your notions of freedom and notions of what is good. This is the same debate we have been having ever since. During this period, as the Senate was opening its debate on the Philippines, Rudyard Kipling wrote and published his famous poem, The White Man's Burden. Actually, the full title of that poem is The White Man's Burden, The U.S. in the Philippines. It's written specifically for this moment. Take up the white man's burden. Send forth the best you breed. Go bind your sons to exile to serve your captives' need. To wait in heavy harness on fluttered folk and wild, your new-caught sullen peoples, half devil and half child. During this period, Mark Twain emerged as a particularly vituperative critic of imperialism. He said that Americans who were fighting in foreign wars were using a bandit's musket under a polluted flag. In fact, he wanted to change the flag of the United States to replace the stars with skull and crossbones symbols. At one point, he lamented, "It was impossible to save the great republic. She was rotten to the core. Lust of conquest had long ago done its work. Trampling upon the helpless abroad had taught her by a natural process to endure with apathy the like at home." Other intellectuals became leading figures in this debate. And it's always impressive to see brilliant college professors emerge and shape the course of history. One of them was William Graham Sumner, now thought of as the founder of the school of the discipline of sociology, and not incidentally the inventor of the term ethnocentrism. This is a line that he wrote more than 100 years ago. Ask yourself how true this came. The great foe of democracy now and in the near future is plutocracy. Every year that passes brings out this antagonism more distinctly. It is to be the social war of the 20th century. In that war, militarism, expansionism, and imperialism will all favor plutocracy. Therefore, expansionism and imperialism are a grand onslaught on democracy. Now, President McKinley had to square this difficult geopolitical circle. It was his job to explain to Americans why it was right, for the first time in our history, to send American soldiers to a foreign land and shoot down people who honestly believed that they were fighting for their own freedom and national independence. He came to Boston and made a speech at a grand banquet. And he used an explanation that still resonates. Did we need their permission to perform a great act for humanity? We had it in every aspiration of their minds, in every hope of their hearts. It takes us back to this missionary view that the United States has discovered a wonderful key to the prosperous, democratic, free society, and how churlish and selfish it would be for us to keep that secret to ourselves. It's our job to spread it around the world, and the people who need it the most are the ones so backward and primitive that they don't even realize they need our help. That's the line that McKinley was predicating in that period, and it still resonates. So the Senate debate, as I said, went on for more than a month. During that month, fighting began in the Philippines. It broke out just as the vote was about to happen, leading a number of senators to suspect that this was more than just coincidence. As soon as news arrived in Washington that fighting had broken out in the Philippines, naturally some senators were more moved to vote in favor of the expansionist project. I believe that the Americans, and particularly President McKinley, truly felt that the Filipinos would welcome us. The idea that the Filipinos had been fighting against Spanish rule for years and were not ready to change one foreign ruler for another never occurred to American leaders. We felt that since the United States was so completely different from any other imperial power, everyone would welcome us. But in fact, of course, the Filipinos, like so many other peoples, viewed us just like any other interventionist power, just the opposite of what we had expected. So the final vote on the Treaty of Paris was a cliffhanger. It went down to the last day. Newspapers were speculating how many senators on this side, how many senators on the other side. The McKinley administration, through Lodge and Vice President Garrett Hobart, was very active in, let's say, distributing emoluments among senators. One immediately became a federal judge after the vote. Another one had took over the naming of all the postmasters in his home state. So normal political means were used, among other great philosophical arguments, to affect the debate. The final vote on this crucial question, and I repeat, it wasn't just on a treaty or about one country. It was about the future direction of the United States. The Treaty of Paris was ratified with one vote more than the required two-thirds majority. Then the anti-imperialists took this case to the Supreme Court. They argued that it was unconstitutional for Americans to rule people anywhere without granting them basic constitutional rights. The Supreme Court rejected that argument by a vote of 5-4. And the Chief Justice who wrote the opinion had also participated in the majority in the Plessy versus Ferguson decision a couple of years earlier, which certified the constitutionality of segregation. It actually made sense, since if you believe that some people inside the United States have more rights than others, you could also believe that other peoples that we govern might have rights or might not. So you had a one-vote cushion in the U.S. Senate and then a one-vote margin in the Supreme Court. It was a very narrowly decided choice. It reflects the division in the American soul that persists to this day. We are, as a nation, both imperialist and isolationist. We want every country to guide itself, but we also want to guide the world. Those are not compatible views. You can't hold both of them, but we do. We've never decided what John Winthrop meant back in 1630 when he famously said, we shall be as a city upon a hill, and the eyes of all people are upon us. So did he mean we should go out into a sinful world and redeem it? Make it godly? Or did he mean we should build a virtuous society at home and hope that others would copy it? We still want to believe both of those things, even though they're contradictory. This is a pattern that I see all the way from Theodore Roosevelt to Barack Obama. They all begin their presidencies very excited about using military power to achieve their ends in the world. Then, as their terms proceed, they begin to see the trouble that this brings. And towards the end of their terms, they tend to be less open to intervention. So Theodore Roosevelt was a great example. Here was the greatest nation grabber in American history. When he suddenly came to power after McKinley's assassination, woe to any nation on which the U.S. had ever cast a covetous eye. There was speculation in the newspapers about where we're going next. Will we annex Guatemala or Nicaragua? Are we going to try to take over Canada? Which slices of China are we going to take? Could there be colonies in Africa open to us? But Theodore Roosevelt didn't do any of that. After his first intervention to take land for the Panama Canal, he never did it again. He moved on to other issues, principally confronting big business and working on protecting the natural environment. And later in life, he always liked to point out that he never ordered an intervention in which a single life was lost. Presidents do tend to calm down on intervention as they spend time in power, which is, I think, a positive thing, although you wish every president wouldn't have to learn the same lesson over again and take several years and several wars to do so. So for me, that is the episode that I'm trying to bring back. I think it also has a great message for us today. I think all of us, regardless of where we are in this debate, can take inspiration from the titans who squared off at this moment. Only once before in American history, at the founding of our nation, have so many brilliant Americans been so intensely engaged in a debate so fraught with meaning for all humanity?